This is Decentralized, the Decentralized Trials and Research Podcast. We gather here with friends and guests to talk about the latest ways to make research and clinical trials around the world more inclusive, more accessible, more resilient, and more sustainable, all by using decentralized methods. This podcast is recorded live on Clubhouse every Friday, 12 to 1 Eastern, on the TGIF DCT show at the Decentralized Trials Club. You can join the live sessions and add your voice every Friday at noon Eastern time with the free Clubhouse app by following the Decentralized Trials Club. And of course, subscribe to this podcast on your favorite platform to get notified of new episodes. Following the club and subscribing will also help you stay current for any of the bonus content we may drop. And now, it's time to decentralize. Hello and welcome to our friends, whether you're joining us here live on TGIF DTRA through Zoom and connected to it through LinkedIn, or if you're joining us through a replay, whether that's a replay directly from the DTRA.org website, or maybe you're jumping in through Decentralized, our podcast share that is available with all of our past episodes, whether Spotify, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, wherever you like to click to catch a podcast, especially in the summer. I think in the summertime, we get a lot more podcast folks. I'm picturing, you know, folks who are loading up the minivan and heading to the beach and want to wear some ear pods to drown out the noise in the back of the car. Hopefully, if that's you, we're keeping you good company for today's drive. Well, we do gather here each week or most weeks, especially in the summer, and we discuss topics related to clinical research, access, participation, and other opportunities, innovations, barriers, and challenges, whether through the perspective of sponsors or sites, of technologists, of implementation partners, and of course, very often, patients and caregivers, and increasingly for a lot of our conversations, policymakers and regulators. Those topics come from you, our community here in the audience. So remember, if there's a topic you'd love to see us cover in the weeks and months ahead, take advantage and let us know. You can always drop a message to myself, Amir Kalali, Jane Miles on your favorite social platforms like LinkedIn, or if you're still out there on X, maybe you're on Threads. I think I occasionally drop in on Blue Sky, or send an email to secretariat@dtra.org. And we'd love to hear what topics are important to you. And if you have content there or publication that you're working on, it's an awesome opportunity to tie it in with a conversation. Our community loves the opportunity to engage with authors or others that are sharing data. And that is a great setup for today's conversation, because we're going to be covering a topic that I love this year more than ever as we dig in around the opportunities, the challenges, and some data and perspectives around including HCPs, healthcare providers, in clinical research, especially around routine care. Jane, my friend, this piggybacks on an interesting conversation from DIA that was like just a minute ago.
Yeah, hard to believe it was a month ago, approximately. And I was really privileged to have the opportunity to lead a session with the four people in the room with us today. And Meghna Chalasani, who is from the C3TI organization within FDA. So what we aimed to do was really surface the topic of how might HCPs be included in clinical trials and what exactly are they thinking about that. So today we're going to get to share with you a little bit of data, a couple of use cases, and then talk a little bit about, gee, what would it take to make this real? The guidance is one thing. The operational plan is a little different.
I love the setup. Amir, any other opening perspectives from you before we jump right in?
No, very sadly, I missed the DIA, so I'm really looking forward to getting this live update and asking really difficult questions.
Of course. We count on you for that.
We'll follow our usual format. We'll have a little bit of conversation here, but the chat is always open. And so if folks in the audience who are joining us live have questions or double clicks, feel free to drop it in the chat. About halfway through our time, we'll open up the room. So if you want to come off mute, turn on your camera even, you can jump in the conversation as well and bring your experiences, ideas, questions in. Jane, should we start with a little background with FDA guidance, or should we jump in and introduce the guests? How do you want to stagger things this morning?
Okay, well, let's start with guidance and then go to our guests and how they're connected to this big idea. So last fall, two separate, well, three actually, three guidances were released from regulators. Two from FDA happened to drop in September. Was I mean, I don't know if that was their plan, but they came out on the same day, late in September. And both of those guidances, one of which was the finalized guidance on DCT elements in trials, and the other of which is what I call point of care trials, that's not the formal name, referenced how HCPs could be involved in clinical trials without becoming investigators, and actually advocated for including these care providers as part of the trial experience for patients. Around the same time, maybe a little bit later in the calendar cycle, ICH R6 E3 E3 R6 got dropped, and that too indicated a new pathway for people other than investigators to be involved in the generation of clinical trials data and to participate in clinical research without becoming full-fledged investigators. So, to me, that was opening a door that had been previously unavailable to us to expand the people who will participate in clinical trials, both from the care provider setting and potentially from the patient setting. So that was the big idea. And then we decided, thanks to Shelley, who said, gee, I wonder what the HCPs are thinking about this, to go test that question with some HCPs. So that's the big setup. Now let's go to some intros.
Well, let's do just that. You mentioned somebody named Shelley. I'm looking around the room and I see one. So, Shelley Barnes, do you want to come off mute, introduce yourself for folks who haven't had the pleasure?
Sure, a little brief introduction. Hello, everyone. My name is Shelley Barnes. I am what's called an innovation lead at UCB Pharmaceuticals based in Raleigh. My role at UCB is really to seek different innovative solutions, be it digital, non-digital, process, service, widget, that will ultimately help drive our clinical trial success. And that is success through our patient participation, retention, and just overall interest, as well as supporting sites and reducing the amount of effort and burden that they have to conduct these clinical trials.
Fabulous. Great. Great as always to have you here, Shelley. And some folks may recognize Shelley's voice. She's been with us before on important topics. Also here in the room, Brittany, would you like to come off mute and introduce yourself and the interesting job title that you hold?
Yes, hi, Brittany Nyland. I'm from Eli Lilly. I've been there 10 years now, and I've recently been in this role of Senior Director of Community-Based Research. As many would know, it's decentralized trial design. We've reframed it as community-based research to be more patient-centered on how we can reach the patients and be more accessible through decentralized trial design. And so that's understanding the external and internal landscape as it's ever evolving. So I'm very happy to be here today. Thank you for having me.
It's an interesting bit of jargon for us to think about community-based research, and I'm sure those words were chosen very deliberately in terms of the breadth of what can be included in scope there. Great to have you here, Brittany. And we have our friend Erica Jacobson with us here today. Erica, welcome. What is this company, Kenovo, that it says on your business card?
Thank you so much, Craig and Jane. Thank you for having me today. My name is Erica Jacobson, and I am a senior director and lead for the qualitative practice at Kenovo. Kenovo is a recent rebrand. We've been known in the industry, and that the industry I'm talking about is the primary market research industry, under the name InCrowd for a number of years. Kenovo is the coming together of InCrowd, Survey Healthcare Global, and GlocalMine. So we are primarily a market research. So clinical research is not my area of expertise, but learning about perspectives of stakeholders involved in any part of pharma, life sciences, medical industry is what Kenovo is really good at and what our team is excellent at providing.
It has been, and I know Jane can attest to this. It has been a lot of fun working with you and the team at Kenovo on this particular project, Erica. It's been, both for the people that you've brought in that have helped us in thinking through the questions, but also the tools that you are bringing to life to get these insights, whether qualitative or quantitative, that we'll speak about in a moment. Using these tools, I know has been a real kick. So it's great to have you here.
Thank you, Craig. I seriously want to thank my whole team, from our CEO Tal down to Jordan, my counterpart on the quant side, Meg, who is a dedicated researcher on the quant side, and Tina on the qualitative. I am here as a voice representing all of the hard work that the team put in. So thank you so much.
Jane, let's talk about this work.
Yeah. Well, before we go into the weeds a bit, a double click on a thank you to Tina, for so many reasons, but one of them was conducting a lot of qualitative interviews on her own. So we'll talk about how she got there, but that was a tremendous work effort and an outstanding output. So backing up, when we started this research project, actually, I think Craig and I were starting to surface this concept a little like 9 or 10 months ago now, based on that question from Shelley, like, oh, interesting that we see this in the draft DCT guidance. By that time, we didn't have the point of care guidance. But did anyone ask the HCPs how they feel about it? And so we worked with Shelley and created a little one pager, and then we started to talk with our member organizations. What do you think about this? Is this an interesting question for you too? And Lily raised their hand and said, we're really curious about that. And that's how we got to meet Brittany. Then we formed a little team and identified Kenovo as our research partner. And together, collaboratively, since about what, February this year, Erica? We've been building the model to actually test how different individuals respond to this concept, what their awareness is, and some of their thoughts about being part of research as non-investigators. So the long story short is that now, with the help of all these people in the team, we have a reproducible model that is built on the Kenovo platform. But I think it would be great to hear from Erica and Brittany about their experience as we went through this, and then maybe a couple of the aha moments in the process of building the model and gathering the original data. So, Erica, you want to get started?
Sure, absolutely. It was our pleasure to get brought in on this. I want to say, like, we started talking about October-ish, November last year. And what we worked out and proposed, as you know, in the way that Kenovo works, is that we're an agile, flexible market research platform tool and consultancy. And so when we came into this, we thought maybe what we should do is start out with some qualitative interviews, talk to some HCPs, then build a survey to validate our thoughts, and then see where that goes. What we ended up doing is one of the best parts of working collaboratively with Jane, Craig, and Brittany and the Eli Lilly team was that at once we got into it, we decided to kind of flip our own script. And we decided to start instead with let's get a bigger view of the landscape first through a quantitative survey. and then go into let's see what we learn there, and then that will drive our second phase, which we think is going to be qual, but let's hold that. So this is very much how we work day to day, but it was a great sense of partners with Jane and Brittany and the whole teams from Lilly, DTRA, and our folks to really talk through what do we want to do. So our first phase was we decided that we were going to look in cardiometabolic, so cardiologists, endocrinologists, primary care. HCPs are, full-fledged doctors as well as NP and PAs, so your advanced professionals as well. And so what we did was that we really wanted to include both, we wanted people who had experience being on clinical trials and those who were completely had no prior experience. So that was our first phase, was really to kind of try to get a big sample. And so we did a first survey of 200 individuals. It fielded over the course of 4 days. And then we were able to talk about the results. And then that was kind of our phase one, and that was how we got started. Brittany, do you want to weigh in a little bit about what that felt like getting to that point?
It was interesting. So I came in, I think, right when the discussion started in February, taking over from a previous role. But I am only one person from Lilly who was on our kind of small but mighty team, kind of giving input. Essentially, we really wanted to sponsor and work and collaborate towards this execution to understand that HCP sentiment. I think it was really exciting. It was very fast and there was a quick turnaround. But I really also want to give a shout out to Tina as well. I feel like she just did a great job within the qualitative and the interviews, and it was great to see in real time and hear kind of the responses we were given. And so one, just collaborative effort and really kind of can help us effectively collaborate and be more efficient in this area in the future.
Absolutely. Yes,
A
we did
couple of
the
boundaries. Like, I'll just set a little context. We limited this to the United States to get started. I think there's, but the team who created the questions was not just limited to the US. So we think we have a model that we could reproduce elsewhere. We also started with folks who are directly aligned to healthcare practices as opposed to including pharmacists or radiologists. And there were some reasons we did that, but that doesn't mean we would always do that depending on the therapeutic area. So I'll back out now. And Erica, you might have some data teasing to do now.
Yes.
And Erica, just
So
before you do that, I have a quick question for you. Some of the audience might be wondering, how hard is it these days to actually get people to take part? I can just imagine providers in cardiometabolic being pretty busy at the moment. Why did they bother answering your surveys?
that's an excellent question. We really feel privileged that anyone in the healthcare space, actually, and all and consumers as well, participating in market research is a really valuable way for all businesses to make decisions. They always want to get a read. How is a doctor going to relate to this new therapy area? Are they going to do this? How are payers going to react to a new entrant? Is this going to be interesting? Will they cover it? So Canovo is at fundamentally, we have our own panel of HCPs, so and across the healthcare ecosystem. So we can reach payers, we can reach primary care, internists, and what we do is that they are compensated through our panel, but they also really a lot of them have an altruistic view of it, is that they want to be able to weigh in and kind of give direction to life sciences and pharmaceutical companies. So we have an incredibly robust panel with deep reach, highly profiled, so we know that every person who here is a real person that we're talking to. And we are also part of our panel and our profiling is that we're able to highly target our work. So they don't get 15 surveys from us in a day, which they don't qualify for any of them. We knew this was going to cardiologists. We wanted to, so we can target to that group and only, so they really are engaged. The other thing for Canovo is that we are mobile first and we are specialized in short form. On my side of the business, short form research. So it's something that an HCP, this survey was designed as an 8-minute survey. So it's really great to get robust responses because we're not asking of a ton of their time. In our qualitative practice, we see a slightly lower response rate sometimes, but we get We had these interviews were 45-minute interviews. We got 30 who participated from the original 200. So this group was highly motivated because they were interested in the topic. And that's really what we try to do is make sure that what we want to talk to them, they want to talk to us about as well.
Great, thank you. Appreciate it.
And the timing blew my mind, right?
The
Because,
timing from like when they hit go to when
yes.
you were hitting refresh on your web browser, Jane.
I think I was actually on my way to the city clinical trials transformation initiative when we went live, and Craig and I both got addicted to the refresh button as we watched the survey results come in.
I love to hear that because our Canovo platform for the quantitative tool is amazing. Like they said, we hit go. This survey for 200 fielded in 4 days from the 23rd to the 27th of April. And that's typical of our work because, again, highly targeted. We know who we want to talk to, and they're an engaged group on our panel. And that platform allows you to see it and dig into and say, like, we had a couple open ends. People were able to see how many responses, how is this trending? Because it was really hard to think about what phase two of the research would look like without knowing what phase one was going to tell us.
So apologies, my timing was mixed up. But the 4 day time frame and the addiction to the watching the data was all real. So what came out of that first survey and how did that inform where we went with the qualitative research? And then we're going to talk a little bit about case studies.
Absolutely. One of the things we learned first off was how aware are they? And that was, we kind of like were everyone was wondering like how much all these guidelines have been released. What does that look like to individuals who aren't investigators? So what we did find is that almost a third, more than a third, 38% had heard of it but didn't really know any particulars, and an additional 20% said they were not at all familiar. So you're looking at a little bit more than half who were not familiar at all. So we were able to kind of inform them. We did give them a prompt on a definition of what this model would look like. And of that, so our remaining 40% were familiar and willing to talk more about it. So that was a really big part, is that kind of just getting a general sense of where we are in awareness. So there is a good chunk of the HCPs out there that could really use a little bit more of education to bring them in. And then that was one of the things we learned. And then we also went on from there to kind of really talk about their interest. And went down a path there of how open, once they were given a definition, and given a slight, giving a little overview of it, what we found was that more than half, 56%, were extremely open and 38% were somewhat open. So that's a really high, what we call in the business, that's like our top two and middle two box on a 7-point scale. That is a really strong level of interest. Only 7% of the individuals participating in these HCPs were not at all interested in participating. So this felt really like buoying, like really good news to all of us when we saw this. Like that was helped us give a direction of, okay, this is good, really good baseline to start our learnings.
Okay, I love that you can contextualize that just against, just talking to providers in this way about lots of different things. Because, I don't do that on a regular basis. And so to me, this is kind of interesting data on an island. And, is that a good signal? Is it virtue signaling, or is it a real signal from providers? And so knowing that you see response data, interest data, sentiment data like this on a regular basis, it's great to hear that even in that context, this seems like a very positive signal.
Absolutely. And I think one of the things that we also really love about being able to dig into data this way is that why are they interested? And that was what we really came out is that the people that were extremely open are seeing the benefit to patients and to the advancement of research. So they really are kind of seeing this as double, like it's good for my patients, it's also going to be good for the greater good. So those people, that's really like they see that then that's strong. So, I don't see a lot of virtue signaling, but I do see that there's that recognition of the altruistic pieces of this. And then the middle group, those who are somewhat open, they are motivated to do it. They're interested, but they're being held back. They're like a little tempered to that somewhat open because they have concerns about how is this going to impact my day-to-day. Everyone who is here today understands that the healthcare system that we work under today is extremely demanding. Lots of different things, demands on their time for patient care, record keeping, billing, all of it. And that workflow is so important. So that's a really big thing. That's the piece that we kind of saw is like, I really am interested, but what does it really mean to me? What's it going to do to my day-to-day?
And that's something that we're hoping to go into a little bit more in our next phase of the research, frankly. We'll stick in the same therapeutic area, but try to go a little bit deeper to understand, okay, so you can't have your workflow disrupted, but what would it take for that to feel like you could participate without adding more to your plate? There may be a magic wand involved in here. I don't really know, but I think that's going to be really interesting. And I'm predicting that that's some of the work we're going to get to do together next year in initiatives to figure out how do you build things so we can make this work. Brittany, I'm curious to hear from you as you were watching the data come in. I know your whole team had the ability to log in and see what was going on. What was your reaction across the team? Anybody was like, yeah, this sounds too good to be true, or were you getting inspired?
Yeah, I think it's twofold. I think it's kind of what we expected to see as well. I mean, just from being, we have patient engagement who are out in the field and kind of hear these same things or understanding the regulations and guidance. But to Erica's point of like, there's factors and kind of motivators behind it. You have the altruistic, you have the scientific, and then what is it going to do to their day-to-day? And so understanding kind of like the importance of being involved of it in the real world evidence. And I think it's going to help us inform when we can get in earlier, engage early in our trial planning as well. And so within kind of this research and needs in the future that you just described that we'll do next year as well, of understanding how we can have industry and HCP participation meet and be collaborative.
Shelley, this seems like a great time to bring you to the conversation because you're actually implementing this model. So you don't have to tell us a lot about your therapeutic area or anything like that, but I'm curious, how did you even get this started within your organization and how did you bring the different functions along on this journey with you?
Okay, so first, let me just try to kind of contextualize what we were trying to do. We were really excited. We at UCB were excited when the guidance came out that it really encouraged, sponsors to embrace HCPs into our clinical trials. UCB is in the rare disease space, so trying to engage many in the healthcare community is something that we're always looking for, different ways that we can to accomplish that so that we can extend our research and extend our participation to a greater patient population. So we decided to really go in and launch a pilot using this concept that was brought forth by the FDA guidance to see if we could make it work in the UCB ecosystem. And we were driven by, goals of hoping to get, greater diversity, in our patient populations. Also really saw it as a way to help build and increase trust within the clinical trial process that maybe could be nurtured between the continued engagement between HCPs and their patients. Excuse me. And then finally to, broaden the exposure of UCB products and our care options through clinical trial participation, really to a network of care providers who typically don't engage in clinical research. So those were really the drivers that we had in there. But to your question, Jane, how we really got started with this pilot, and how we realized that the impact of this new way of study conduct, excuse me, would impact a large number of functions across our company. So we wanted to first build an internal community of functional subject matter experts who would evaluate this model and kind of help us to mold it into a strategy that would work within UCB's ecosystem and as well as align with the guidance. So we started, I guess, over a period of roughly 6 months or so, this comprehensive due diligence of the model, excuse me, and of the operational considerations specifically for use in a target study. We did identify a study that we thought might work for us to pilot this, but we really wanted to get the input from the different functional groups. That was the main thing, and that was our attempt to, exercise our change management, building this community. And so we, worked with over 12 functional teams across UCB, and it was quite an extensive effort, So we had, oh goodness, I'm trying to think. We had participation across legal, of course, quality, both clinical and device quality, our IT security and data privacy, global medical, regulatory, patient safety, of course, but then also looking at, I had said legal, but our financial teams, for fair market pricing and transparency and reporting, and then finally our site and patient engagement groups. So it was really important to us to really get the different perspectives of what this model could bring and how we could operationalize it in a way that would work well across our company. Without going into all of the details, I will say that as a result of this due diligence, 53, I believe the number was 53 risks were identified by the different functional teams, of which we collectively mitigated or came up with mitigations for every single one of them. So this again brought the community together because all of the different SMEs recognized that we were serious about getting their insight. They were being seen and they were being heard, and they collectively worked together with us so that we could develop these mitigations. And through those mitigations, we also developed a 5 go-no-go gates so that we could work incrementally through this process within a study and not negatively impact the study, or at least we could measure how we measured the impact to the study. So we had these 5 go-no-go gates. So between those two things, the community building, which has been phenomenal, and the risk mitigation and gate definitions is how we've been able to move this pilot forward.
So first, bravo. Convening that multi-stakeholder group probably took more than a week or two.
A little bit.
Second, I commend you for being so diligent and thorough. I've done some of this, and I can imagine that some of the stakeholders were able to either verify a risk or maybe debunk a risk just by having them all in the room together. Did that happen?
Yes, exactly. It's amazing how, perceptive is everything, and so when we were just talking like transparency when reporting, and just as an example, the realization that, well, if we implement this model the way we think it's intended to be implemented, the HCPs have to get paid, but how do we pay them if, while there's no firm guidance, saying that a sponsor can't pay an HCP, but if we're paying them, does it come across as, you know, we're influencing or, you know, creating an environment that will aid increase question to an environment that's already questioning trust to begin with. So just a whole lot of conversations and people entering into, you know, really what is the risk that we're going after, as opposed to the opinion or feeling that people may have about a situation. Those were the good conversations that came from having all of those SMEs together.
I'm also going to just project for a second because I am imagining, and I don't know that this is true, but if you're listening to this and you're from a solution provider who's trying to support these sorts of innovations in trials, it probably kind of blows your mind that there were so many people involved and so many risks identified. That's probably why you think pharma is so darn slow and stodgy. But I have to say that the investment in the upfront work is actually what clears the path to make it possible. That's been my experience anyway. Craig, you may have something to add there.
Noticed,
Just
I noticed there's an interesting comment in the chat to I think for Shelley, which is, could you possibly elaborate on any of those risks or any of your top three? Is that possible?
yes, actually, I can. So what's excuse me. apologies. I'm actually on the positive end of the COVID stream. So I still have this cough that gets worse when I'm talking a lot. But we took the risks that we had and categorized them. So we had several different categories, but three risk categories really bubbled to the top. And they were PI or sponsor oversight, which you can imagine. You know, there are a lot of questions about, oh, how do we know that the HCP is actually doing what we want them to do when we want them to do it, how we want them to do it? The other part was data integrity and solution maturity. You know, this idea of HCPs and clinical trials, it can go all over the place. You know, so being able to try to put some definition around how we at UCB think that it could work for us so that we had some guardrails to work with. Given the fact that this was a brand new idea that was being brought forth by the FDA. Excuse me. And then the third one was, oh, no, those were the two. So data integrity was one, and then solution maturity was the third. So with regards to data integrity, it's really if we're introducing this third party, the HCP, into the clinical research, you know, environment, how do we make sure that we can follow the data, you know, and in a way that doesn't create a lot of overhead for the site or the HCP, is inconvenient for the patient, but still maintains that data integrity so that the data that is ultimately collected can be used successfully for the study goals.
Great, thank
And just to double click there on data integrity, I'm going back to Erica because we actually asked some questions about the concerns that the HCPs had about being in the trial. So we talked about the workflow concerns and making sure that doesn't happen. But what else showed up at the bottom of the list, Erica? Because this was exciting to me.
Yes. So when we talk about their concerns in trial participation, their top ones always are workflow disruption and added operational complexity. So those are the knowns. We know that. But what we were surprised to see really came down to the bottom of their concerns was that there were low patient interest or willingness to participate was the lowest of their concerns. They really, you know, so if we kind of flip that, they think that patients are going to be interested in participating. So that's one, like really, like that's a nice thing to see. It might buck some of the wisdom or what we may have thought before we asked them this. And then the other one that was lower in terms of concerns was uncertainty about the reliability or accuracy of routine care data. I think that that is one thing that we are definitely happy to see that that was a low concern for them.
Yeah, and I think that we wanted that in the question pool because that topic got a lot of airtime, if you will, in the draft DCT guidance and needing to assure that the data would be similarly rigorous and accounting for this in your sample size, which, by the way, I recall we at DTRA made a strong comment to, like, you're talking to investigators and to HCPs who've all been trained to do these things. So maybe we need to relax some of those concerns or understand what they're founded on. So the great news is the HCPs feel like if you're asking me to do something that I do in routine care, I got it. Now, how the data flows, that's a different question. But I was really excited by that. And I can say that a lot of those concerns around data quality were tempered in the final version of that DCT guidance based on the feedback that the group writing the guidance received in the comments period. So, super excited about that.
Well, I have so many questions as well, and breadcrumbs that I thought were interesting from this work so far, and certainly a lot of questions on my mind about where this type of work goes. How do these insights start to influence the way we think about operationalizing and actually engaging with HCPs in different ways in our studies going forward? But I'm also very curious to hear from folks that are here in the room with us. So certainly, if you have questions, ideas, perspectives, some have been dropping in the chat. Fabulous. If you want to bring your question into the room here as well, you should have a hand-raising icon somewhere there in the Zoom screen. You can take advantage of that. We'll grab you and pull you up here with the crowd, and you can share your experiences here as well. Otherwise, keep taking advantage of the chat, and we'll keep an eye over there. Brittany, as you're thinking about, well, by the way, one breadcrumb, Erica, that I didn't expect, and it's definitely stuck with me as an example, was I think there were some clues in there about HCPs wanting clarity around legal obligations for them. So certainly as researchers, we're concerned about our compliance, our data integrity, me, me, me. But they have questions as well and want to better understand the consequences or considerations for them. And so that certainly speaks to things that maybe we can start to demystify or tools or job aids we can start to create that can help to clarify that for providers.
Yeah, I think that it was about half looking at the data were had concerns about legal or liability concerns, and a similar number also were kind of looking for a little bit more guidance around compensation for time and efforts. And so that was about half. So that's I think that's really where there can be the it's again, if we can demystify through education and background to these, like we can probably overcome. And it might take us digging a little bit deeper into saying, like, how would you like to hear about your roles and responsibilities and knowing where your legal liability ends? Like that could be actually together in like a material that's provided as part of the, as part of the study, is to basically more clearly lay that out in a way that makes perfect sense to everyone involved.
Well, I'm very curious then, Brittany, maybe as we think about the use of insights like these and experiences that the community is starting to develop, whether this research experience like Shelley was describing, how does this start to influence the way you think about action? And how does this manifest maybe differently as a research sponsor? Are there other considerations around this curve from this being something new to how we implement this type of engagement with HCPs? And are there other, I don't know, other hacks that maybe we're learning and clues we're getting that can help us to do it better as we start to try new models here?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think, I mean, I hit on it a little bit earlier of just like from a community-based research perspective of getting early in the trial process and understanding. But with the FDA guidance and kind of what we were hearing from this, HCP survey, and even hopefully in the like the future one that we're doing of just the synergy that allows us to leverage the expertise of HCPs, we are excited to do that. We want to do that. We know this will help enable our community-based research, but also meets where the patient is as well. And so we want to allow these patients to receive this care in their existing healthcare through this decentralized design, but that decreases the burden. So I think there's so many things that we can think of. So obviously collaborating internally and externally, taking this feedback and seeing where we can, implement it earlier and understand the guidance that's been released as well.
Craig, you're on mute, my friend.
Fumbling for that unmute. Shelley, any nuances for you as you're building on all these experiences as you think about implementation and what that can start to look like? Maybe things that you'll do differently over the next few months that may have looked different from how you originally thought about this field, just based on the insights and experiences being gathered so far.
So that's a good question. I think, the challenges that we are having, and actually, I won't even say they're challenges, they're opportunities, because this is so new, and us as an industry, we tend to recoil a little bit when we kind of push towards the edges of something different and new. But I think that for us, it's really the work that that Brittany and Erica are doing, trying to, I think if I had to do this all over again, I would really kind of lead in or lean in to getting more feedback and evidence from HCPs that they are interested in this, that here are the areas where they feel as though this new model brings opportunities to them and why they would be excited about engaging in it, as well as lining, some of the barriers that they see. So that's something that we could kind of focus on. But bringing that knowledge and insight into this process, I think would have created a different type of environment, especially as we were looking to actually implement this in a particular study. So I look forward to the continued effort from, from these guys, and definitely a cheerleader for them as they continue to move forward with it.
So that's a great segue because I think we're just about to launch phase three of this research project, again, continuing in the cardiometabolic space. And now we're going to flip the script a little bit and try to get some insights from both people who have conducted or are conducting clinical trials as investigators, as well as those who haven't and are in the HCP domain. Because as Shelley is bringing up, it's the HCP considerations, but it's also the PI will to engage in a different model and to feel like they're operating within the boundaries of GCP and ICH by doing so. So I'm very curious to see what comes out from that, how they feel protected as investigators, and who needs to actually offer that protection to them. I don't have those answers. I'm hoping we get some of those in this next phase.
As you think about that next phase of research, Jane, is there sort of call to action for others? Are there or should folks just stand by and wait for more great insights to keep getting shared and externalized?
Well, we've been starting to think a little bit about some of what we predict will be needs we have to address for this to be workable. And thanks to Shelley and Brittany and Erica for helping us define some of them. I see a question in the chat, but I'll drop a couple of breadcrumbs. One is, how does the contracting process work? Who owns the contract? Is there a best practice, or is it sort of a choose your own adventure depending on what your level of risk tolerance and comfort is? What are the PI oversight guidelines that might help both the PIs and HCPs feel like they're operating in a model that is sustainable and works within the framework of guidance? And then Shelley dropped a bomb yesterday in a good way. Like, what the heck is standard of care? Who defines that? How could you actually help a study team figure out what is considered standard of care? So those are three things we're starting to think about. And the call to action is, if you have another, let us know. And also, if you want to help us solve for this, let us know.
Jane,
So
also,
we do.
standard of care is not standard.
That is so true. So that's the thing. Do you really need to define this at the individual practitioner level, or is there something more macro that we can offer to teams to feel like they know how to assess this?
And I guess, one thing that is helpful for us at least is sometimes we get trapped in this standard of care in terms of the treatment regimens that prescribers are providing to patients. And we know that these vary wildly in many indications. Will you be started with drug X or drug Y? Will you be started at dose A or dose B? Here we're talking much more about the procedures and that for which a practitioner, whether NP, phlebotomist, physician, pharmacist, is trained to be able to perform. But of course, those do also vary, and people as individual providers vary in terms of how much they've honed and used those skills. And so ask my, HCP spouse to do certain procedures that she hasn't done since she was a resident, and you probably will not appreciate the outcome as much as some NP that does that same procedure every single day. So these are definitely some great questions for us to weigh. And Jane, we do have a question for Shelley and Brittany that's coming in the chat from Adrian, who is asking about, based on the work thinking through some of the risks, how will HCP expertise get incorporated in improving the protocol if the regulator doesn't see the HCP involvement as needing protocol knowledge? So that's an interesting twist, Adrian, because if the regulators are saying that, at least in some reviews, that HCP involvement is not, that the HCP doesn't necessarily need detailed protocol knowledge. How does their expertise, or where does their expertise need to be reflected within the protocol? Brittany, Shelley, Jane, any takers? Shelley?
I can speak to that. I'm sure Brittany has other perspectives. I do think it's a very good question. It's something that we're kind of tackling right now as part of our pilot. I think what's really interesting about this, and maybe I can give an example, is when does standard of care start and stop, and when does training of the protocol begin? And so we have this interesting scenario just in sampling, something that many people in my organization think, blood sampling is blood sampling is blood sampling. But we do have others that feel like, well, you have to do the blood sampling exactly in this, stepward approach. And in order to do so, you have to train on the protocol. So I think it's an education, a process that we have to go through to determine how much risk, is involved if we just look to make sampling align with healthcare sampling versus sampling having to be specified within the protocol. We're not there yet. We are trying to figure those out. And that's why I say I think it's a really good question. It's very relevant to the conversations that we're currently having, within our organization. So all I can say is stay tuned and, see how we navigate through this. But I do think that part of this overall exercise, and I hope to eventually get to, is really having a conversation internally with those within our company that design our protocols and design our studies to see how can we evolve those to be closer to healthcare, activities, so that when we have the conversations when we're all out in these conferences and we're like, clinical research in healthcare, bringing them together, how do we really do that? Anyway, I've talked too long, and give Brittany the floor, but I hope that that helps answer a little bit of the question.
Yeah, it is a really good question. And Jane, you hit what I did. There is an iPhone message on the chat that I am very interested to hear, as well as a local HCP that has participated under clinical trial activation. However, I could just give a quick little snippet of Shelley, you hit on it, but I think it's identifying those factors that impose the greatest burden on sites when employing these clinical trials. And so understanding kind of what standard of care, which we've already hit on, as well as distinguishing between like procedures and standard of practice and kind of that qualification and training. But I'll pause and see if that person wants to say anything.
Sorry, if that's me, this is Adrian. I just wanted to say thank you to both of you for that. For me, the question is, again, it's still within the protocol itself. There's been so much, I guess, back and forth as to whether or not, there that expertise can be brought in, without more, I guess, if you will. Of their involvement in the actual upstream protocol design or development. And I think that's still something that, as you said, stay tuned, absolutely. But I guess I'm wondering whether the regulator may come back and help us to understand exactly where the, I guess, that line is. Because that would be obviously very, very helpful, right?
Jane, as we're wrapping up in the final minute or two, there's a great comment in the chat that came from an anonymous iPhone, but a local HCP who actually does call out having participated in a trial under the supervision of an investigator. This individual calls out an interesting challenge that, on the part of both the PI and the research staff, a limited understanding of the patient's care pathway and the operational reality of local HCPs. So I think to whoever that individual is, please feel free if you'd like to explore that further in an upcoming installment here, feel free to reach out to secretariat@dtra.org. We'd love to hear more about individual experiences and stories like these, and perhaps be able to include your voice in an upcoming session so we can explore some of those pain points. Jean, I just want to call out as well your share there about looking for institutions that maybe have figured out some of this process. And so plenty for us to cover in some upcoming sessions on this topic. Jane, I don't think we've planned to solve it all in this hour, have
No,
we?
not going to solve it all today, but I will say that I feel like we're committed to going on this journey with other people who are really curious about how to make it work. Adrian, please reach out to me directly on LinkedIn and we'll schedule you, if you're willing, for a whole session on this topic. You can bring along your sponsor, your PI. We'd love to dig in on this. And then I'm just going to drop a breadcrumb because I'm trying to figure out how we might talk a little bit about pragmatic trials and how to design them so HCPs could be involved and we can optimize data flow. But that's for another day.
Because for this day, we are out of time. And so I would like to thank our special guests this week, Brittany Nowlan, Shelley Barnes, and Erica Jacobson for joining us. It has been a fabulous journey studying and exploring and learning on this topic together. I think we're just cracking the tip of this, and I am really thrilled to keep going down this journey together. If you have topics you'd like to see us cover in the weeks and months ahead, drop a line and let us know. Otherwise, please enjoy the rest of your Friday. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Bye. Thank you.
Thank you.